Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. The best new podcast in Canada is about a war. The war on drugs and the war on drug users. It's a story told by drug addicts, self-described war correspondents, who report on the battle from the trenches of downtown Vancouver. The podcast is called Crackdown.
Well, I'm sorry, we can't take it anymore when we have to go home to our communities and they're fucking dead!
The very first thing I ever said after using heroin, the very first thing I said was, I turned to my brother and I said, I feel normal. Now that's kind of an odd thing for a 12-year-old to say the first time they ever used heroin.
I walked across the hall and knocked on my neighbor Simon's door. Simon was my heroin dealer. I asked him if he knew where I could get some methadone, and he told me, I sell the disease as well as the cure.
Crackdown breaks the traditional rules of journalism. You're not supposed to be a main character in your own story. You're not supposed to be an activist. Crackdown's host, Garth Mullins, is both of those things. And yet, in breaking those traditional journalism rules, Garth and his team of war correspondents are putting the traditional media to shame, creating the most urgent and compelling coverage of the opioid crisis that I've ever heard. And Garth Mullins joins me from Vancouver in a minute. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Mia Travers Hayward, Sarah Spring, Ryan Rowell, Melanie Anderson, Corey Jackman, Wes Babcock, Victor Dwyer, and Gavin.
Hi, my name is Gavin, and I live in Pubnico, Nova Scotia. I shoot video and teach music for a living, and I support Canada Land because I like the content and I like how you hold the media accountable.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer. And it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Garth, before I ask you any questions, I think I just have to congratulate you on producing an excellent podcast. It's a really good show.
Oh, thanks very much.
The way that you describe what you're doing you are journalists and you are activists, but you also describe yourselves as war correspondents. You've taken on the language of the drug war. Like, it's like I don't know if you're accepting or if you're appropriating the Reagan era classification that there is a war on drugs. Are you being cheeky, or do you feel that there is a war on drugs? And if so, is it the same one that Reagan was fighting?
Yeah, I think both. Like, I'm always a little bit cheeky, but also there sure still is a drug war. I mean, there still are tens of thousands of people arrested every year across Canada for possessing drugs. People are dying at a rate that's never been seen before, and they're dying from policy choices, from legal decisions and legislative decisions. And so it absolutely is a war. There are sides. We want you to know us. We also want to expose the people who are on the other side who are killing us, because they have names, they have jobs, they have titles. And so why not cover this like a war? I mean, too often it's been covered like a force of nature or just a very sad thing, or even like a redemption story. Oh, look at this comeback kid who's made good. And all of those narratives don't capture the way I've experienced it anyway.
Even using the words that the media has taken on, it's a crisis. It kind of underserves it as a news story because, you know, you can only kind of have one news cycle where you go, oh, my God, crisis. And then it just becomes like, oh, yeah, fact of life, crisis. And so the crisis language kind of fails, whereas to cover it as a war, like, I hate to put it in such crass terms, but it has legs. There's a narrative to a war. A conflict has a beginning, middle, and end. And the way that you tell these stories is different.
Yeah. And you know, just in my life, this is the second overdose crisis that I have lived through. So I was a injection heroin drug user all the way through the first one. I'm on methadone now. But over these two crises and the time between, I've lost half of the cohort of people I came up with. You know, I tried to count. I got to about 50 and I had to stop. It was doing my head in. These are big wars, big elements of campaigns with fronts. They almost feel militaristic. The police response is definitely militaristic. You're right. Crisis sounds like, you know, an environmental crisis or, you know, like a bad storm is coming through or something like that. Like, we all agree, isn't this terrible? Let's send some relief aid or something. But this is actually willful and intentional and malicious.
And I it's probably useful for us just to kind of take the bright line bullet points. Where are we at right now?
We sort of have gotten up to about 1,500 deaths a year in BC, probably about 4,000 in Canada for the last 2 years.
Each year?
Yes. So, you know, in BC and Canada, it's shortening life expectancies. So the average life expectancy is shorter because all of us who've died. And it's, you know, the number one cause of death for a certain demographic or a certain age group of people, like above car accidents and suicides and other ways that you can go out. I mean, it's not getting better. It's not waning. And in fact, if history of these crises is any indication, there may be a lull at some point, but then there'll be a worse, deeper thing to come.
Getting back to the war metaphor, it might not be an exaggeration to say that the Canadian media itself has declared war on drug users. Just to have a look at a few things that have been said, Rick Bell of the Calgary Sun called drug users scumbags. The Red Deer Advocate referred to a place where addicts hang out as a zombie apocalypse. Margaret Wente, of course, has written repeatedly against safe injection sites. She's asked the question, does naloxone really save lives?
Yeah, is the earth really round?
Yeah. Like,
that's a good column topic for next week, maybe.
How about this one? The new editor-in-chief of the Sun newspaper chain, there's a national newspaper chain in Canada, Mark Tuohy, formerly chief of staff for Toronto Mayor Rob Ford.
Yeah.
He has tweeted, Doug Ford is right. There is 0 point keeping people alive just to suffer in perpetual misery. And Tuohy has also said that fentanyl is the best thing that's ever happened to drug addicts. That is the editor-in-chief of a national Canadian newspaper chain, I think, saying that people like you are better off dead.
Well, fuck that guy. What a piece of shit. No, seriously. He's saying me and my friends can go off and die and thousands and thousands of other people in Canada. And this guy's, you know, at the helm of a very well-read chain of dailies. You know, it's shocking. It's why we exist, is to basically say, fuck that guy.
A lot of people agree with him. There are,
well, fuck them too.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. I mean, this is like, do you think the lives of people are worth living? And where do we extend this to? Like, if you get in a car accident, should we say, you know, maybe you made a choice or missed a light or something. You know, somehow this, you could have some agency in this, so we're not going to send an ambulance. We'll let you burn up in that. You know, like, how do you organize a society around let people die? You know, it's an incredibly regressive position, and it's also super unscientific, un-evidence-based, doesn't understand the reasons and the ways people get into the risk of an overdose to begin with.
I think that your war starts there, and I wonder if it's winnable. The conception that I feel is probably widely held, though not expressed as often as it's held, that drug users are a blight, that they cause all kinds of social problems, and that perpetuating their lives through ongoing treatment perpetuates societal problems. The best counter evidence to that is persuasion. And I think that just what you can achieve in a podcast with your own voice, in humanizing yourself and others, if anything can change people's minds, it's that. And yet I also feel like fuck those people. And like, is that your audience? I mean, in a sense, that's probably the best thing you could do, is show like that your life is worth living. And yet for you to have to advocate for your own humanity feels, I don't know, gross to me.
I mean, it is gross. And I do say flippantly, fuck those people. But I realize I also have to convince them. And, you know, I think where we start is we organize amongst ourselves. I try to show people the world of drug users that I see, which is a lot of people who are activists who've been fighting for their own human rights for a generation, for 20, 25 years. And we've won all the things that you see now. Safe injection sites, naloxone, needle distribution. These are the things that we actually fought for, and in some cases did illegally first, and eventually became more but not entirely accepted forms of public health intervention. So when I started using was just at the end of the big sort of 80s, early 90s HIV AIDS crisis. And Vancouver had the highest rates of transmission infection in the industrialized world because of the policy to not allow new needles, new syringes to be obtained by drug users. So people shared and it spread. And so there's a policy decision right there. They just cost loads and loads of people their lives. And we started by having people actually liberate medical supplies from their workplaces. And you hear a guy like that, a practitioner, a healthcare worker, who stole boxes of syringes from his workplace to help deal with it.
Can we say redistribute instead of steal? Because let's...
Okay, so Thomas, you liberated and redistributed clean, new syringes for people to use?
Liberation and redistribution is a concept I can live with. I'm not going to admit to stealing on this podcast. And
what was the moment? Do you remember, like, a night where you're just like, fuck it, I gotta do this, and when you're leaving some office or some place, you're just like, this box is coming with me?
You're really asking for a lot of disclosure around this.
Well, only what you're comfortable with. But look, to be honest, we're trying to give other people who are listening the courage to do the same sort of thing. Yeah. There's a lot of doctors that listen to our podcast. I want them to break the fucking law. When the law is wrong, I want people to resist the law. You know, I was one of these people. I had the same syringe for a month at a time sometimes. I had to sharpen it on a matchstick. I have blown out all of my veins because of stuff like that. And I'm super lucky to be here. So many people aren't. But it's a simple policy measure. And I understand that homeowners may sometimes say, oh, I saw this syringe on the street, you know, and I agree, that shouldn't be there. And so we also organize ourselves and obtain funding to go pick them up, to go clean that stuff up. And there are people in any city who are drug users who would be glad of the work to go and pick that stuff up. It's just a question of how do we organize? You know, do we organize being stingy with healthcare supplies, or do we organize to take care of the neighborhoods? These are all choices made by human beings.
Well, that's something that your show does really well is put into story form and explain how the part of it that touches, quote unquote, you know, regular people's lives in a way that they find negative is directly a result of policy. That's sort of a theme again and again, is that the kind of criminal behaviors that people feel personally affronted by happen because of policy.
Absolutely. You know, I think about TUI and their conservative friends there talking about how our lives aren't worth anything and maybe what kind of strategy to use to close down safe injection sites in Ontario and how to communicate that in the press. And they might do this over a scotch. You know, they might have a couple of drinks at the end of the day. And prohibition applied to alcohol first, you know, back in the day, it was illegal to buy and consume alcohol. The day before prohibition started, everybody's favorite drink was beer. There was no problem. The day after, people started making moonshine. It had to be smaller and stronger, easier to smuggle, easier to get away from the cops. And so people started to get sick. People died. People went blind. And eventually you had prohibition repealed. And now I have no idea where to buy illegal moonshine. And everyone's favorite drink is beer again. That policy decision to make booze illegal actually made a whole bunch of people criminals who wouldn't otherwise have been. So before Canada made opium illegal in 1908, people smoked opium. And then since it's illegal, you had to make it smaller, you had to smuggle it. Each drug user had to get more value for money because it's a little more expensive or whatever. Then you have the rise of injection drug use, and you get stronger and stronger drugs all the way through up until in my life. Like I said, I've seen two overdose crises, and it keeps getting stronger. You get an introduction of new things like fentanyl and carfentanil, and I don't know what the next even stronger thing will be, but it's the iron law of prohibition. This is a policy that just drives us speeding into these crises.
I mean, that crisis, the fentanyl crisis, is the urgency that fuels your show. And when you talk about how, like, our drug supply is toxic right now, it sort of casts things in a different light to me to say, well, like, accept that there is a drug supply, accept that people are going to use drugs, and it is toxic right now. A lot of the drugs that have been tainted with fentanyl are drugs that I have done recreationally. Like, it's like a dispatch from a specific community that feels, you know, exotic and foreign to me. And yet the connection points keep popping up as I listen to the show, that this is about everybody, or at least somebody that everybody knows.
Yeah, we're a little exotic and weird, but we're going to the suburbs for the next episode.
Oh yeah,
and we're gonna tame it right down. And the one after that, we're going to Portugal. So we are going to take people to different places in different worlds.
Wow.
So that they can see that, yeah, you know, the people who are making the show, or me and the editorial board anyway, we might be wired sort of daily opioid users, but there's lots of people who have just partied on the weekend, and you know, they've just hit the wrong thing. They've got a pill that they thought was something and it was something else, and they're gone now, you know. So the fact that there's people out there saying, drug users should just go on and die, well, they probably have kids, you know, and their kids might experiment on the weekend or at college or whatever, and they're vulnerable too. And so we actually make efforts to protect them too. So I go and I teach university students and university staff how to use naloxone kits. And, you know, we're trying to protect the kids of probably some of these very conservative people who don't give a shit about us.
You know, talking about how you're a daily opioid user and likening that to, like, there are people who are daily alcohol users, and we have accepted that that is something that people can do. That's a big leap for a lot of people to accept that you can do that for the rest of your life. And it won't make you a thief. You're not going to spread disease. You're not going to leave syringes. Like, it's none of their fucking business at a certain point. I think the charge is hypocrisy when you talk about imagining those critics who think your life is worthless sitting down to their Laphroaig at the end of the day. And yet, as forthcoming as you are about your own ongoing drug use, you also say in the first episode that you've never talked about it so publicly before. Why now? Why on this podcast? Why break your silence about that?
I haven't really talked about it so much. I didn't keep it a secret. I just didn't make a big show of it or kind of advertise because, you know, I wanted to get jobs. Like, I've worked as a freelancer at CBC before, you know, making radio for ideas. And I don't think they'd hold it against me. But, you know, there's this different way people look at you about filing receipts for travel or something like that. And maybe you also can't exactly get, you know, jobs where you have a laptop, or it just changes the kind of life trajectory that you get. You know, people won't rent you apartments if they know. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stigma around there. But also, as the years of the crisis went on, I started to feel guilty about that. So in 2014, you know, I started to have this weird feeling of deja vu. Like, I get that spidey sense of things are kind of seeming familiar again around my neighborhood. And so I just started feeling this sense of like, I should be using my skills and my activism and my ability to make radio to do something. And you know, the consequences be damned on me. Like, I gotta come out about this. And so eventually I did. It took me a little while, but I just, you know, you lose friends and you see people making tremendous sacrifices to try and change the world. And here I am sitting, you know, passing basically as someone who doesn't use drugs. And, you know, because I've learned how to like code switch into very professional sort of talking. Like, I don't always say fuck that guy as my first starting point. So
that's how one represents on Canada Land, I suppose.
Well, I guess I'm in the right place then.
Yeah. Laura Shaver, your colleague, she's the president of the British Columbia Association of People on Methadone, a board member on the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, and an interview subject on the podcast.
The worst thing about this is it just shows again that we have barely any input. You're on methadone now, this is what you will be taking as of February 1st. We have no choice.
You guys, I'm really sorry that this is happening.
Don't, it's all good. Like, this has to be real, right? Like, whatever we're doing, it's just, this is what's happening in our life.
Yeah.
After listening to that old tape with Laura, I asked her to do another interview. This one starts out very differently than the last one. Laura's cooking up heroin.
She was supposed to join you today for this interview, but was unable to. What's the story there?
Well, we have an editorial board, and everybody on it is an activist and a drug user. And so we have people who've, you know, gone to the Supreme Court, and we've lobbied the Prime Minister and met with international dignitaries. But we also kind of have experience with jail and homelessness and speed, crack, coke, heroin, fentanyl, all that stuff. So one of our members was named Cherise Keewatin, and she died about 3-4 weeks ago. She was very close friends with Laura. I knew her for about 6 years, and so it's kind of thrown us into a bit of chaos. We had to you know, figure out a memorial and a funeral and stuff like that. And then there are a couple of related but adjacent legal issues that are still playing through. And so Laura, I couldn't get Laura today. I guess it's a little moment into our workflow that the criminalization of drugs and drug users is so incredibly disruptive to our lives that it can make things really difficult to plan. So we have to build a process that's flexible, that meets people where they're at, right? Like, some people are like, let's edit the tape, let's edit the script. And sometimes the challenges of life close in and you can't quite do what you're trying to do. So we made it. Episode 2 was about how a drug treatment, you know, an addiction treatment called methadone was kind of messed with in BC by some government decisions and a big pharmaceutical company, and led to lots and lots of misery for people here. And also in Ontario, a lot of people got switched to a new big pharma form of methadone called methadose. And methadone is supposed to do one thing: keep you from feeling dope sick, keep you from having those withdrawal cravings. It's kind of like a nicotine patch, you know, you don't have to smoke. It sort of takes care of the cravings for you. Well, this stuff would fail after about 12 hours. You're supposed to take it once a day. And so people were spending half of the day now dope sick again. So they would have, you know, like, stopped using, gotten on methadone, not been using heroin, you know, put their life back together. Then all of a sudden a government decision happens and they're thrown right back into the place they were before. Well, that happened to Cherise. It also happened to Laura, but Cherise never was able to bounce back. So after the switch, it was just like a tumble downhill, and now she's gone. And You know, we're really mad as hell about all of it, and we're trying to get some redress from the government. So we lost her. It's made Laura's life more difficult. And Laura told me, you know, keep going after those bastards, you know. So we're doing all the investigative work and FOIs and, you know, tracking down the lobbyists from the big pharmaceutical companies, you know. So we're trying to put tools of investigative journalism in the hands of the people who are most affected by this stuff. I guess that's a long way of explaining why my friend isn't here.
No, it's instructive. And, you know, look, my preferred delivery system for information is narrative storytelling in audio form. Listening to your show, I realized how little I know about this stuff that I've been reading about for years. Your life as an ongoing methadone user. So this is a way basically to prevent yourself from getting sick in a perpetual ongoing way. This isn't a way to get off drugs. My understanding is you don't get high from methadone.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, you can taper off methadone if you want to. You have to do it over a long, slow period. But, you know, I know for me, I've been on some opiate or another my whole adult life. And if I am for the rest of it, then so be it. And I just want it to be one that comes from a pharmacy and isn't going to kill me and isn't going to bankrupt me or put me in jail. And that right now is methadone. And I just want those kind of options for everybody. Methadone doesn't work for everybody. There's a lot of barriers to getting on. And it just, you know, I developed my habit a long time ago. For people who are getting there, getting wired right now, fentanyl's a lot stronger. So you may need stronger medications to treat it.
Even if you are part of a, you know, the progressive and humanitarian approach where you're part of a methadone program, there's still something so dehumanizing, as you describe it on your show, of being completely at the mercy of pharmaceutical companies and government who just say one day the decision is made, and it's quite likely a business decision that you're not getting methadone, you're getting methadose. And everyone's screaming out to say this is turning people back to heroin, and you know, it's falling on deaf ears. When you describe that as a story and where that story is coming from, it's incredibly compelling. And it does explain, I think, what the bright line point of all of this, which is that the social ills and the social cost of this are, again, it's because of bad policy.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to get this story out as soon as it was happening, and I had a lot of trouble. Vice published me a little bit, but I couldn't really pitch it, and I couldn't get it to go very far because it is a bit of a complicated story. Like, it took us just a few minutes to explain it there. And that's the nature of a lot of the overdose crisis stories. They're kind of layered. They're complex. And I guess part of the podcast is my increasing frustration with not being able to kind of land these stories properly. So we just thought we would try and do it ourselves through a different method. But another thing I realized is going and trying to meet with these government senior management type officials or ministers or something, they do not believe drug users. They just look at you with such suspicion. Like, I can just feel it, you know. So we started bringing along, well, this one guy I met, Dr. Ryan McNeil, who we bring on the podcast sometimes, and other people who've done research. And sometimes they've done research at our request on stuff so that we can then say, well, see, it's not just us. It's not just in our heads, or we're not just making up a story to try and somehow bum drugs off the government. Here's some research that really documents what the ills are of this particular policy.
I have never heard you, you know, sell a mattress or push for a meal kit service. How was Crackdown funded?
We have funding from research, like the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, and from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. So it's like they provide funding for people to do research, and some of it is called knowledge transfer. So when there is research, if you're good at explaining it to other people, there are small bits of money that you can do that. So we very creatively said, well, of course, that's actually what we do, or a good part of what we do. So we sought money that way. But I don't know if that's a sustainable, like, ongoing model or what the future of that is for us. But it got us a push start anyway.
I think that one thing we haven't touched on that is immediately going to jump out to people when they hear your show is that it's pretty graphic.
And here we go. Too fast.
Sheffy is lying on the linoleum. Kevin has pulled a chair into the room. Reaching down, he gently aligns Sheffy's head. He runs a finger along the protruding neck vein, slides the needle in, and pulls the plunger back. Just a touch. A red flag of blood blooms in the syringe.
Some people just keep going, and it's wasted person's hip in the neck is the most dangerous spot, so you got to make sure you stop.
Kevin's a fairly big guy. Sheffy is smaller. And something about the way that Kevin is cradling Sheffy's head looks very tender.
Okay, take your breath. Take a second. Okay, go.
Kevin discards the used needle into a sharps box and cleans up. Everyone is just kind of looking at Sheffy lying on the ground.
Are you all right?
Yeah.
Why don't you get up? We got company here. Make it look bad. Make us look bad. Fucking.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
He looks at us and smiles.
Hold on to me. I just want to see my baby today.
Why did you want your listeners to hear people actually doing drugs and injecting opiates?
You know, I really thought about that a lot because there's so much stigmatizing coverage of people doing drugs on TV news, especially, you know, they'll just show a picture of somebody shooting up in an alley or something like that. And so my first instinct was to not do that. But when we have Laura and we're sitting down for an interview about how this new methadone isn't working and it's feeling dope sick to her, and she's having to do a hit before the interview, that's part of the story. And she told us, you know, use it, do it. This is happening. This is the stakes. So we're actually putting it in the context of the person. I actually wanted to show a really lovely moment between two people there, between Kevin, who's this kind of big, rough guy, and Sheffy, who's this littler guy, and that Kevin was helping him do this hit in this really gentle, giving kind of way. And I wanted to show like a different side of all of that, you know?
It's a really complicated scene. It's an evocative scene. It's a really complicated, there's so much going on in that scene. The fact that Sheffy just finished his shift of helping other people, then he's being sort of tenderly helped himself, but it's visceral and there's an element of danger you describe. You're fucking around with jugular veins, bad stuff can happen. And then there's his reverie when he gets high and starts to sing. And you're plucking on so many strings in me as a listener. Like, I got to tell you, Garth, like, I'll listen to, you know, a 30-minute podcast on where the opioid crisis, the overdose crisis is at right now. I'm not going to listen to episode after episode if you're just describing the crisis to me, but I'll listen the shit out of your show because it's got great stories and compelling characters, but also because you take me to places I'm curious about. I can see things where I would never want to go myself. And I'm also kind of curious about what it's like to get high in that way. I'm a tourist. You let me safely visit what it's like to be a drug addict. I got to ask you, how do you navigate the line between storytelling and journalism and advocacy on the one hand and exploitation on the other?
Well, we have an editorial board of the people who are organizers and part of the community and responsible for running groups that everybody's in and that are, you know, involved in overseeing that same injection room where we took you. So there's direct accountability. People aren't going to tolerate being made an exhibit of or something like that. And then we play tape back to people. Like, we have a listening party and play an episode. And if people say, no way, don't do that, then we'll miss our deadline and we'll recut the tape. We haven't done that yet because we've built our approach along with everybody. You know, we've been choosing with the editorial board of, you know, seven people now, you know, the topics and what we're going to cover and how we're going to cover it. And in episode one, you almost hear a little me sort of at the end of the episode there kind of summarizing our manifesto. But we actually wrote out how we want to do stuff, you know, and some of that is like punch up, don't punch down, which means hold government officials and people in charge accountable. But for people who are at our level, people who are marginalized and on the bottom of society, we want to increase solidarity and agency among and for those folks.
Do you worry that you might make drug use look attractive?
You know, I don't think if you come with us and hear about Sheffy getting hitting the jugular there, I don't think people are like, wow, I want to do that. We talk about dope sickness. We talk about the incredible struggle. We talk honestly about the people who've died, and you know, we haven't really ever described what it's like to be high. We haven't talked about euphoria and all the sort of cliches that you find in literature about, oh, it's like, you know, a big hug or, you know, whatever it is. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think people go watch Trainspotting and then start using drugs. I think people probably end up using drugs because of the conditions in their lives, or because human beings have just, for the whole history of the world, used substances, you know?
Where are you going with this show? Like, what would be the best thing that could happen? Is the idea to just keep telling these stories? You are upfront about the fact that this is an activist project. There's specific policies or goals you're trying to reach, and then it's like, okay, mission accomplished, no more stories. What's the end game?
You know, if there's decriminalization and safe supply tomorrow, then we probably don't have any more stories to tell. But that's not coming tomorrow. We're in a drug war in Canada that's been going for 110 years. It's probably got some more years in it. So I would love to affect those kind of outcomes and those kind of changes. Pretty grandiose dream for a podcast. So we'll keep making it. Along the way, I hope we can just accidentally stumble into a new model of journalism, or maybe it's an old model of journalism. Like maybe back in the day, Hannah Arendt or George Orwell or whoever, they didn't worry about being an activist and an advocate and a journalist and a writer and all that all at the same time. Maybe that's a modern illusion or conceit. I don't know. And I'm not comparing us to those folks, but I just mean there are ways of doing journalism where you can say, here's the side we're on. Here's what we're fighting for. We also use all of the tools of journalism, like the FOIs, investigation, fact-checking, turning to the science.
And doing accountability interviews. You put people on the spot.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, we have put out requests to all kinds of people. You know, we got screwed around by the Minister of Health and the Minister of Mental Health and Addictions here trying to get interviews with them, and they just played around for 3 weeks. I mean, people know how that goes, right? And so we are trying to get those folks. And if they still want to come on the podcast, we'd gladly have them. If Mr. Tui would like to come on the podcast, I would gladly speak to him in much more polite terms.
Yeah, fuck that guy. That's your Canada Land episode. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me about it at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is at canadalandshow.com. New episode of Oppo this week, but not much happening in Ottawa, so no need to bother. I'm being sarcastic. It continues to be insane. Listen to Oppo. This episode is produced by Kasia Mihailovich. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do here at Canada Land and you want to support us, one of the perks is ad-free versions of our podcasts. Check out patreon.com/CanadaLand. We rely on your help.
They're calling us a corrupt petrostate. They're calling us the dirty old man of the climate world.
When we were writing our vows, we said it would be for boom or for bust.
I have approved pipelines that the previous government wasn't able to do.
That's when the vandalism started. Shots fired at gas company offices. Gas well sites blown up, including one explosion set by RCMP as part of their undercover investigation.
I grew up in a place where I couldn't even breathe, and that's not my fault.
I don't know why the textbooks don't teach this. It is the major industry. This is why Canada was built.
Canada is oil country. It's what drives our economy, divides our politics, and shapes our nation. This season of Commons is called Crude, and we're bringing you stories about Canada's relationship to oil. The good, the bad, the ugly, and especially the weird.
And you would drop that into the well, into the oil pay zone, and you would set it off.
So they're shooting missiles at the Earth.
Yes.
To hear it all, subscribe to Commons from Canada Land wherever you get your podcasts.